Right, if we're ready to start, thank you to everybody for coming on a most inhospitable night. Before we start, could I ask you, if you have a mobile phone, to please mute it or turn it off, because we are being recorded. Just a brief word of introduction as to how the evening will go. I'm sure most people know who I am. I'm Charlotte Grimley. I'm a member of the Nottingham WDM group. What we're going to do tonight is, first of all, Benedict Southworth, who's the director of WDM, will talk to us for about 15, 20 minutes. Then we'll have an opportunity to have some discussion and then feedback from that discussion, and hopefully that will stimulate some interest at the end. So the title of tonight's meeting is Climate Change and the Campaign to Eradicate Global Poverty. So we're tackling big issues. I always think that climate change is a rather benign way of describing what we're facing, and that there are other words that might actually describe what's happening in a better way, such as chaos or catastrophe. And people react in different ways when they are facing chaos or catastrophe. And I heard somebody who's interested in the interaction between ecology and psychology describing the way that people react to chaos in this way. If you picture yourself on a ship that is about to strike an iceberg and sink, people react to that in different ways. Some people become paralyzed with fear. Some people ignore the oncoming catastrophe. Some people decide there's nothing they can do, so they may as well go to the bar and consume all the alcohol that's there. Some people realize the trouble that you're in, but wait for the captain to tell them what to do. But then there are some people who organize themselves and decide to either try and steer the ship away from the iceberg, or if that's not possible, at least to mobilise the lifeboats and get as many people as possible off the ship in time. And we're not faced, unfortunately, we don't have the option, unfortunately, of abandoning our ship as we are cruising towards disaster. But I think in WDM, we do actually have an organisation which can enable us to organise to try and mitigate the worst effects of the disaster and perhaps stop us from ploughing headlong into the iceberg. And maybe we'll hear some more about that during this evening's presentation. So I'll hand over to Benedict Southworth, who is director of WDM, who's going to talk to us about climate change and the campaign to eradicate global poverty.
Great, thank you. And thanks for the opportunity to speak to you tonight. I hope I'm going to make a strong argument for storming the bridge and taking control from the captain. I'll stay sitting down if it's all right. It's a bit more cosy if you can all hear me okay. The World Development Movement was set up over 30 years ago to secure justice for the world's poor. And we base our work on some very simple premises, that it's unjust that people starve in a world of plenty, that it's injustice that some people get cured of disease and some don't, that some people have opportunities and some don't, and most of all, that some people are able to look to the future with hope and hope for a secure livelihood and a secure future for their children, and some people aren't. We also believe that that's not an accident, that those injustices are caused, that injustice is maintained by decisions taken thousands of miles away from those people most affected by them, and the lack of control over people's decisions, and by the fact that we in the richest countries of the world have built a relationship with those poorest people in the world which keeps them poor. And it is in that context that we look at what is happening with climate change. And I think we would strongly make the case that climate change is a massive global injustice. The World Development Movement and others have struggled very hard over the last 35 years to bring the issue of global poverty to the fore, to mobilise people and to take action. We have actually, looking back, come an enormous way from the days when we were campaigning to get the UK government just to recognise the fact that global poverty was something that they should do something about. To have moved on, to have eradicated private debt, to have managed to persuade G8 leaders to deliver some additional debt relief means that we are actually on the right track. But here we are with this issue of climate change that threatens to put all the success that we've had on global poverty back by decades, and also to set in place those injustices that we so strive against. And I want to talk a bit about what climate change actually means on the ground. And I just have a quick show of hands. Who has seen An Inconvenient Truth by Al Gore? Let's do it. Okay. So I'll cut the science out because I can't compete with Al Gore's graphs and that little machine that raises him up. But let's just have a look at some of the impacts. Many years ago, I was lucky enough to work on a project that was bringing together photographs of some of the world's greatest glaciers and how they looked 30 or 40 years ago and how they look today. And it is shocking when you look at the retreat of those glaciers, how much the impact of climate change is visible in such a symbol of the power of nature. But the really frightening things about that retreat is that 1/6 of the world's population relies on meltwater from glaciers for their water supply, for drinking or for agriculture. And already you're seeing the impact of that. If you go to Peru or to Bolivia, you can see whole cities whose water supply is being reduced down. It's making worse a situation where water supply is erratic already in those cities, where people don't have access to clean drinking water, actually already seeing an additional pressure on those cities. This is millions of people already affected by this. You're already beginning to see a reduction in flows in the Ganges, in the Mekong. Already the great rivers of the world are beginning to be starved of their water supply. To make matters worse, you go the other way and there's an increase in flooding. If you look already at the erratic nature of the weather that we're seeing, and perhaps tonight is a good example of that, considering on Saturday I was out in the garden smelling my daffodils, and tonight I was huddling from the railway station in the sleet. That erratic weather causes havoc when you don't have the infrastructure to deal with it. It is no good ploughing millions of pounds into education, for example, if you get one hurricane that comes and wipes out all your schools, which is what happened in the 90s in El Salvador and Nicaragua. There's going to be people who are flooded. That flooding is a precursor to a longer term and more severe problem of sea level rise. The inexorable rise of sea levels over the next couple of hundred years. It's not actually the Armageddon pictures of St. Paul's with the waves lapping on the dome that are ones that we actually have to worry about. It's the insidious encroachment of salt water from the sea onto freshwater supplies. And already the World Development Movement has had somebody out in Tanzania, in Dar es Salaam recently, and she came back and she said, already, in normal situation, water is in short supply because of the problem of seawater coming into the freshwater supplies. With the sea level rise, that's going to happen over large and large areas. It'll happen in Bangladesh, it'll happen in Egypt. It'll be the precursor to the large-scale loss of land in places like Bangladesh, in Vietnam, and the mass migration of people that will result from those events happening. And I think also one of the thing that I find horrendous is the impact of drought. And already, if you look at sub-Saharan Africa, it's about 80% of the agriculture in sub-Saharan Africa is dependent on rain rather than irrigation. There is going to be a decrease in rain in those areas, and it's going to become more erratic. Already, we see, and I'm just going to read out one quote, there's a guy in Zambia. He says, "People can always withstand bad harvests and bad rains, but when it happens so often like now, it is hard, and every year it happens, we become a bit weaker, and every year we become a bit poorer." At the moment, we have one country in sub-Saharan Africa that basically can't feed itself even when there's a good harvest. What will be the case if that happens in 2, 3, 4 countries in sub-Saharan Africa? Just how deep can our compassion be before fatigue sets in? And often you sort of hear people talk about the fact that, well, we need to adapt to climate change. And I want to give you a very brief example from Australia. And Australia is suffering from a 1,000-year drought. And the reason I'm giving you an example from Australia is because you may have guessed it's not a very poor country. In fact, it's one of the richest countries in the world. It has an amazing infrastructure and capacity for supporting its population. It's probably got the last proper welfare state in the world. Because of that 1,000-year drought, a large number of farmers, almost the majority of farmers in 3 states in Australia, are on the welfare. They're on drought relief. They're killing their animals. They're walking away from their farms. They're committing suicide, and their communities are dying. If you go through those areas, I drove for 8 hours and saw 2 rivers with water. People are leaving the land, and they will be on welfare, on relief, for 3 years before their farms can recover. That's if the rain comes next year, if they don't get another drought. This is one of the richest countries in the world. What on earth is that going to be like in one of the poorest countries of the world? Now, that's a great case for how climate change is going to impact the poor. But I think the thing that strikes a chill down my spine is that we have responsibility for that. It is absolutely clear that it is the wealth creation in the rich northern countries which has had as its byproduct the polluting greenhouse gases that is causing the problem. And historically, about 80% of the man-made buildup of carbon dioxide in the environment comes from rich countries. The world's poorest countries, and I always look at this figure because I just can't quite believe it, the 50 poorest countries account for just 0.5% of emissions. In the UK, we emit, on average per year, something like 9.6 tonnes of carbon dioxide. We did a comparison as to when someone in the UK put out the same as someone in a developing country did over the course of the whole year. Malawi, it's January the 3rd. It is our lifestyle and our wealth that we take for granted that is causing the problem. And that's why it has to be a responsibility of the countries in the north to take action on climate change. Because we have an historical moral obligation to take action. And we have a self-preservation obligation to take action. Because whilst poor countries will feel the effects of climate change first and they'll feel it worse, it's not like we're going to get away with it. There's a very practical reason why we should take action on climate change here in the UK. Because if you go out and you ask people in Southeast Asia, South Asia and China, you say to them, and this is a cross-selection from business, from civil society, right through to the general public, what are the three things you need to start taking action on climate change? Number one, out in front. Those countries that caused the problem so far have to take action on it. Because if you don't think it's serious enough to take action on, why should we ride to your rescue by denying us the type of wealth that you've generated on the back of this pollution? Seems like a pretty coherent argument to me. Second and third, just to be complete by a very long way, is money for adaptation to the climate change that is going to happen, because it's already too late to stop some of it. And the free transfer of technology so that people can actually use and take low carbon technologies and actually build up a model of development that doesn't require repeating what we've done and the mistakes that we've made in building an economic system based upon fossil fuels. And I think we have an interesting time or moment here going on, because those people who used to deny that climate change was happening have switched to a different argument. I think it's the drink everything out of the bar argument. Those same people are now saying, oh, it's too late, never mind. What we should do is we should just carry on, we should burn all the fossil fuels we have. Surprisingly enough, I hear that quite often from fossil fuel companies. We should burn all the fossil fuels that we have, and we can give more charity to developing countries to deal with it. I believe in justice more than charity. I believe that we have a responsibility to take action on it. But what do we have to do about it? Well, what's happening so far? Well, what we have to do about it, I can give you the technical argument, you probably all know it, we have to reduce emissions in the UK by somewhere between 60 and 90%. And we have to get a global economic framework that will enable other countries to reduce their emissions too. So what's happening in the UK? Well, we have a target, a 60% by 2050 target set by the UK government. And we have a European Union target of reducing by 20% by 2020. All sounds really great. The thing that slightly concerns me is the backdrop to this. We had a little look at what's actually happening around various government departments at the moment. So the Department for International Development, well, they're doing their bit. They're supporting funding of fossil fuel projects around the world. That's going to help. One of the Foreign Office's key priorities is to secure access to sources of fossil fuels to maintain the UK's consumption levels. That's going to help. That could be why four of the last five heads of the UK diplomatic service have gone straight from government to be directors of major oil and gas companies. And the Department for Transport, well, they're planning to double the number of passengers at UK airports. Seems to be a little bit of a disconnect between the target setting and what's actually going on. And that is, I think, where we come in. Because the World Development Movement actually worked on climate change in somewhere about 1989, 1990, trying to get the United Nations to put a framework convention in place for climate change. And it happened, which was fantastic. Since then, in the 15 years since then, which makes me feel very old, there has been a massive battle raging between the vested interests of those people who didn't want action on climate change and those people who did. And let's get the brutal, honest truth out on the table. They won for a long, long time. They denied the science. They paid for scientists, they paid for PR campaigns, they bought politicians and they bought governments. They poured vast fortunes into making sure that we remained confused about climate change and had a little niggle of doubt at the back of our head. And what has happened in the last few years, in this country in particular, is there has been a groundswell of public opinion basically saying, we don't buy that anymore. We can see what's happening in our gardens, we know what's going on. More and more we've had exposed what's been happening. And now we have what seems like an absolute explosion around the issue of climate change. We have a bidding war going on between Brown and Cameron. You know, we have this huge kind of, it's in the media every day. But I have to remind you, we've seen this before. What is needed now more than ever is for the public to put pressure on to achieve real action rather than words. That we not just deal with the odd light bulb change and tinkering around the edges and actually deal with those systemic changes that are needed on climate change. Because we need major reform of the way in which we do business, and we need, if we're going to tackle climate change, we're going to have to change the nature of our relationship with countries in the South. It means we're going to have to look at our economic relationship with those countries, our political relationship with those countries. But there are a couple of starting points. First, we do need those targets, but we need real targets, set in law, year-by-year targets, so that we can actually measure progress. Not nice statements of intent that tend to sort of flitter away, that we can't get to grips with. And we need every sector in our society to take its fair share of the pain of doing this. And I, quite frankly, I don't believe we can do this in a totally painless way. And we need to stop letting sectors off the hook. It is why we've been campaigning to get proper taxation of aviation and to get rid of the subsidies to aviation, because we believe that we need to stop the planned growth in aviation, because otherwise the emission reductions in other areas will have been wasted. It really won't matter if we all go out and take personal action if flying continues. And we worked out that we all pay, man, woman and child, £172 a year to the aviation industry in subsidies. We switched that money and started putting that money into solutions to climate change, solutions which were locally driven, then we might be a damn sight better off. And there is a real sense for me right now that climate change forces us to look at ourselves as a society, because whilst we need leadership on this issue, it actually needs us, the actual solutions to climate change will be built community by community. And I say that rather than individually by individually, because I think what climate change forces us to do is to actually look within our communities and work out how we can both take action on climate change but act in solidarity with those people being affected by climate change. It is exactly the same ask that we have around global poverty, and the two things are intimately connected. Ricardo Neves, who's a El Salvador activist and environmentalist who was over here recently, said climate change is like going out for a slap-up meal and then handing the bill to the poorest person in the room. And if we don't take action on climate change, that's what we're going to be doing. We're basically going to be saying our lifestyles, our way of living, our wealth, we're going to cling on to that at the expense of you. We're going to cling on to it whilst you don't get yourself out of poverty. We're going to put you in poverty. We're going to keep you in poverty. We're going to make it worse. We're going to keep you there. because that's the price we're prepared to pay. It's not a price I'm prepared to pay. I don't think it's a price you're prepared to pay. But quite frankly, it's a price that some people are prepared to pay. And that's why meetings like this are so important, because we have to go from these meetings and we have to make sure that our voices are heard right now at this important time, when real decisions are being made month in, month out, about what the future will look like and what our relationship will be with the poorest countries and the poorest people in the world. That's the time when we need to be taking action, because we can't sit back and wait for a few years to figure out how it all kind of flows out, whether Cameron's the saviour or whether Brown's the saviour, you know, or whether in fact Min Campbell's the saviour, but we didn't really know about it because he never gets any media time. You know, we need to be the saviours. We need to be out there acting in solidarity and getting on with it. And I'm going to stop there, because I was told to speak for 20 minutes and I've already spoken over that. But I just want to end with one quote, and then also to sort of to maybe set out some questions, because I think what we'd like to do is to break up into smaller groups and have a more general, get a more detailed discussion going. And it's a quote from a guy who lives in Bangladesh, and it really struck me, and I'll tell you why it really struck me, because I was listening on the radio to a Harvard economist. Now, you know, I don't normally recommend that, except unless you're trying to get to sleep quite quickly. And it was very interesting. He was asked the question, don't you think that if you know an action will benefit somebody in the future and in a developing country, don't you think that that's worth doing regardless of the return on investment that you get for your money? He had a very simple answer, no. In that context, let me read you out this quote. It's from Atik Rahman from Bangladesh. It says, we are angry with the people who are doing this. We have made no contribution, but suffer the highest impact. That makes it a huge case of moral inequality against which the global citizenry, the global nation states, must take action. If not, we'll be calling it climatic genocide. I think there's a very simple choice here. Are you with the people of Bangladesh? Or are you with the Harvard economist? Thank you. How do you want to do this?
Well, I don't know. I was wondering whether there's probably enough of us to split into two or maybe three groups. And to enable us to have a little bit of discussion, and then perhaps it would be good after that if we can sort of report back on the results of our discussions. Would people find that helpful? Yeah. Have you got some questions that you'd like to pose? Perhaps if we hear the questions, and then we'll decide how contentious we think our discussions are going to be, and we can decide how small the groups need to be.
Well, I mean, I don't... Discuss what you like, basically. Yeah. But these are just some questions that I was thinking about. One is, you know, how can we, as campaigners, break through the noise on climate change to actually get people to take action on it, political action on it? How do we get across the connections between climate change and global poverty and the scale of injustice that climate change represents? And how do we connect the actions that individuals might take in response to climate change with a need for also taking political action? And there were the three that kind of instantly...
That sounds good to me. I mean, I think one of the things that we wanted to get out of this meeting was that there would be we would feel practically energised to go out and actually do something, to suggest personal action, but also how we can act together in order to bring some of the things that you've spoken about more to the fore. So perhaps do you think three groups? Yeah, okay. So should we say, I noticed how many people, people want to take their chairs over into that corner, and then if people want to sort of go over towards that direction, then everybody else can stay kind of in the middle. So I don't know how you want to split yourselves up, but maybe the people in the back could sort of shuffle off in that direction, and the people on that side can shuffle a little bit in that direction, and then the people who are at the front stay where they are and just turn around and...
How can we break through the noise on climate change to get people to take action? How do we get across the global injustice of climate change and the connection with global poverty? And how do we connect individual responses or action on climate change to the need to take political action as well?